Hello, everyone. You're listening to the Paradigm Shifts podcast with your host, Keisha Kruger. I'm an organization development practitioner and executive coach, working with leaders to create positive changes in the workplace using behavioral science. My personal mission? Share science-based tools and leadership insights from the field that you can use in the workplace and beyond. Considering we spend about 3/4 of our lifetime at work, there is incredible science and organizational psychology that could be used to rethink the way we work, lead, and ultimately live. Join me as I speak with thought leaders and business leaders in practice, unpacking light bulb moments for paradigm shifts. On this week's episode, I had the great pleasure of speaking with Dr. Bonnie Green, an experimental psychologist who specializes in research on success, particularly as it relates to academic achievement and reducing recidivism. Her application of cognitive development, psychometrics, and mathematical modeling allows her to improve educational access, achievement, and success for those coming from vulnerable or oppressed backgrounds. She holds the rank of Professor of Psychology at East Stroudsburg University of Pennsylvania, and she is also the Chief Scientific Officer of Illumin Analytics, which is a minority-owned data science organization designed to help organizations use data to illuminate their path forward. They specialize in diversity, equity, inclusion, access, and justice issues at the organizational level, and they are focused on how data can be used to move organizations forward. Dr. Green is also a rotating program officer at the National Science Foundation under Education and Human Resources Division of Undergraduate Education, and the author of numerous books on statistics and psychometrics. For more information about Dr. Green and her upcoming work and services, please visit the show notes. Hi, Dr. Green. I'm going to call you Bonnie if that's okay, because
that would be wonderful.
Have a great relationship with you, and you've been such a mentor for me in this discipline and field that I'm in. We were talking before we hit record. I have to show everyone. I pulled out this book that you recognize, but those tuning in wouldn't. My very first quantitative psychology class or course with you in my undergrad was really what changed the direction of my career, because you made me fall in love with statistics. So I just have to thank you sincerely for just getting me on board and just loving this this work. And you just, the way you teach is incredible.
Well, thank you. I have always loved teaching statistics and psychometrics and research design. And one of the first things that I realized when I had started teaching out of grad school was that there wasn't really a good statistics book. And so to help my students, that's why that book came into being.
So I have to tell you a funny short story, very brief. I actually made a name for myself at my organization because it was one of the first year that I was in the corporation, and I was delivering a presentation to our managers and above. And I was talking about engagement surveys, and I brought up the psychometrics report, and I should have read the room a little bit better. But as soon as I dropped that word psychometrics, I have not heard the end of it. To this day, I am still made fun of in a nice way, but made fun of for using that word. And it's funny in that sense, because from my point of view, I know others may not understand really the gravity of what psychometrics is. But then it's also kind of disheartening too at the same time, because how critical psychometrics are and the gravity of that in a survey. So can you tell me a little bit about psychometrics and what that means?
Sure. So the field of psychometrics literally translates into measuring humans, right? In fact, I wrote a book for undergraduates called Measuring Humans, The Principles of Psychometrics. And what it's about is how do you measure humans, right? So much of what we're interested in measuring, for example, in the workplace, might be things like trust or effective communication, or maybe appreciation for diversity. And these are really complex and intangible, in a way, constructs, but we need to be able to measure them, because without the measure, we can't move forward. And we have examples of that throughout all of science. Anytime science advances, what takes place first is the advancement in the measure. And so psychometrics, or measuring humans, is absolutely a critical component for us to be able to understand what's going on, for example, in the workplace, and then take that data and make use of it so that we can make targeted improvements.
It's really important when people in our roles or in our field, and they are partnering with organizational leaders to select assessments within the organization to really consider all of the psychometrics, the validity and the reliability reports, and take a look at those. Mm-hmm. Maybe you wouldn't share them, but in order to select the right assessment, you would look those through and make sure that they are appropriate. And I think also in the HR space, it's critical when you're using assessments for selection, correct?
Oh, definitely. And one of the challenges, so there's lots of different components here. And you mentioned the most important, which is validity. Validity of a measure is the accuracy and usefulness of the measure. Mm. And it's not easy to validate or to verify that a measure is actually accurate and useful. But this is absolutely critical. However, when we talk about job selection, there's another piece that's in there that you can have a measure of accuracy, but then there's another component which is called fairness. Mm. And so when we're taking a person who has been raised in an environment that has had systemic barriers that has held them back, let's just use a quick example of quantitative reasoning. So you have a child who's been in a very weak K through 12 public school environment, and they have not had the opportunity to develop their quantitative reasoning skills. And now you give them a measure of quantitative reasoning. It could be valid. It could be accurately picking up how much quantitative reasoning they have at that particular point. But it might be masking other things like the systemic barriers that they had had to overcome. And there might be more quantitative reasoning skill in there. And so as you look at your measures, particularly for selecting employees into a workplace, you want to make sure that you're not adding to any systemic barriers that have already been there and missing out on really good and high quality employees that have the potential to grow with the organization.
That's a really important, and I think the point that I want to explore a little bit more is around that fairness. So when I'm guiding our HR department around selection tools, I emphasize the fact that this is just an additional data point, right? Because we want to look at the whole person. So when it comes to utilizing things like in terms of hiring individuals, and let's say we're measuring critical thinking or quantitative reasoning, how do they assess for fairness? Like, what's the best way to do that?
Oh, that's a really, really good question. And your point on that it is one data point is critical. Donald Campbell, who was like the father of quasi-experimental design and really was one of the first people who dove into some of the challenges that we see within psychometrics, had introduced the concept of triangulation. And it's funny because people will say, well, you have to have three measures, right? Because there's three sides of the triangle. But what he really was saying wasn't that in order to capture a construct, you needed three data points. It was that you needed more than one,
Mm-hmm.
And depending on what you might be measuring, it could be an awful lot of data points that you might need to do to factor in. And I think probably one of the easiest ways to take a look at fairness is, you know, take a look at the makeup of the team that has been hired, right? Mm-hmm. And are you selecting measures that get beyond a bias that all organizations have? And it's just human nature. It's called organizational replication, right? Mm-hmm. We like to be with people who connect with us, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe they have, you know, they have shared how they grieve that's similar to ours, which might align with our religion or our culture or when our generation, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe they share similar music types, again, which aligns with all of the things that I said. And so, but we feel more comfortable in that environment, and we may naturally go to replicating that. And so I'm going to give you an example. I was talking to this young woman. She was just hired straight out of college for her very first job. And it is a job in managing a sales store, right? A retail store. There is nothing gender specific about that, right?
Right.
Now, it is a sporting goods focused store. Mm-hmm. There are 63 managers across the nation. There are exactly 3 women. Yes. Wow. Right there.
Why do you think that there is?
There is probably some bias in the measurement protocol that they're using for the selection criteria. And it could be something as simple as manner of speech, right? Because we know that in language, in general, women and men have differing speech patterns. Mm-hmm. And this particular young woman has a masculinized speech pattern in large part because she was raised in a household with lots of masculinized speech. So, you know, her lived epistemology, her lived experiences masculinized her speech, even though she's feminine in all of her external appearances. And my guess is that there was probably, because she did have to go through a communication, several communication components, that they were drawn towards a particular type of speech pattern, not even recognizing that they were biasing towards men versus women. The additional piece in was the knowledge epistemology, right? That knowledge that she has in the sports space. And however, in this particular space, and I don't want to get into too much details because I don't want to identify the organization. In this particular space, there are literally, because of Title IX, yay, there are literally 2 female college athletes in this sport for every 1 male. And so one would think that it would be pretty easy to find women. But when you start to see those kinds of patterns, mm-hmm. right, then that should tell you something. There was another organization that I had an opportunity to observe where all of the senior leadership were white and all of the unskilled labor was Black. When we start seeing patterns like this, and then this is probably telling us that there's something missing in how we're measuring and making that determination on who comes in. And you know, I'm not saying that you have to make sure that the proportion is exactly whatever it is in your region, but it should be a whole lot closer to that. And if there isn't, it's time to step back. And I don't want you to feel guilty about it mm-hmm. because it's human nature. It took a lot of years to get to this point. But the beautiful thing is it won't take that many years to move into a healthier place. And it really does start with measures that that you take a look at that are both valid and so it's accurate and useful. And then fair, that it's not taking somebody who's been in an environment, in a culture that has put up unnecessary barriers and keeping and facilitating and adding to those barriers.
It seems like bias awareness training for those who are in roles where they're required mm-hmm. to select or hire would be important. Training, right? That's common sense.
Actually, this is really challenging. Yeah. So I have you and I didn't even talk about this ahead of time, but I've had the fortune of working on a major nationwide committee taking a look at diversity, equity, inclusion, and access hiring practices, because that is one of the spaces in that DEIA space, and measuring in that DEIA space is one of the areas where I've been very active over the course of my professional career. And so I felt very fortunate to be brought in, and I was brought in literally as the measurement expert to help with the measurement formation as they were trying to understand how this massive organization and with all of its tiny components were making these decisions. One of the biggest challenges that we have with bias training, though, is that just simply bringing in bias training, there's some substantial research on it. It actually doesn't fix bias thinking. And in fact, it has the potential to increase it.
Wow. Right? Wow.
Which is a real challenge. And that's why, if you noticed before I made a comment, don't feel guilty about the place where you're at right now, right? What we find is sometimes what happens with bias training is one of a couple of things happens. One, a person feels guilty, like, oh my goodness, I did this terrible thing. And, you know, when I'm contributing to racism or sexism or whatever kind of ism, and that's not who I am. And now they feel guilty. And what happens when we're guilty?
They
Our working memory
overcompensate.
Decreases.
Oh.
And not necessarily. Our working memory decreases. And now we need to protect our self-esteem. And we back off into this attitude position like, wait a minute. As soon as that happens, it's like, wait a minute. No, I'm hiring people with the right skill set. Mm. It's not my fault that there aren't enough, take for example, PhDs who are African-American or PhDs who are Latino. It's not my fault. I'm not the problem. And if that's the case, you've just washed your hands of the situation and you don't have to do anything intentional to work past that. And so that guilt is not helping us. It decreases the working memory capacity. The other piece that happens with attitude is if, like, let's say, we're just going to use something simple, like I prefer, one type of spaghetti sauce versus another type of spaghetti sauce. And maybe it's just slight preference over a red versus a white sauce, right? And somebody comes in and says, no, the white sauce is so much better. The clam sauce or the carbonara or whatever is so much better. And you're like, no, I like it this way. And literally the attitudes polarize.
Right.
And so we have to be very cautious of this bias training. My recommendation actually is instead of bias training, first come in and take a look and do some basic measures, right? Mm-hmm. And understand. So one of the challenges that we have to get over is, of course, the organizational replication bias, mm-hmm. right? We like to hire people who are like us. There's this one organization that I was working with. Almost all of their PhDs came from a single institution. Can you imagine that?
It doesn't surprise me. I talk with our managers when it comes to performance reviews time, and I know this is shifting slightly, but I do talk with them about different biases to be aware of. And that's similar to me bias, right? Like I'm likely to rate you higher on a performance review because we have shared experiences. I mm-hmm. like you. We went to right. the same institution. Maybe we have an alma mater that is the same. So it doesn't surprise me to hear that. It's disheartening, but it doesn't surprise me.
Right. It's amazing. And you stop and you think about how many amazing PhD granting institutions are out there. You can't tell me that there wasn't somebody
right.
else out there. So you have to take a look at those kinds of things. Take a look at the demographics and see if there's any organizational replication going on. But there are, my research team and I have found three primary variables associated with the ability for an organization to establish an environment that understands that we cannot be successful if we don't have what IO psychologists refer to as functional diversity, right? Mm-hmm. So people coming in with different skill sets. I always use the example of the football team, right? Mm-hmm. You can tell if you're a football fan, you can tell the difference between the center, the quarterback, the kicker, right, the wide receiver. They have different body shapes. They have different skill sets. When they're out on the field, they are not interchangeable, but they have to work together and they need to know what they need to do. And the goals have to be set. The vision needs to be clearly communicated. And now they have to know their job. They have to practice it. They work together. They move forward. You cannot have a football team with a bunch of quarterbacks.
Yeah.
Now, if you can translate that understanding into an organization and this idea of the appreciation of diversity, which includes not just expertise, mm-hmm. but also lived epistemology, lived experiences. I have to give you this one example.
Yeah.
There was a study several years ago, now probably 25 years ago, that fell flat on the face. It was looking at ovarian cancer, testing it through saliva,
mm-hmm.
right? And they wanted to predict ovarian cancer. Hugely important. Most of the time, by the time it's diagnosed, it's too late, right?
Yeah.
And they designed the study on how they were going to collect the data from these women, right? But the research team was all men. And there were some really basics. They said, well, you know, where do we find women? At the gynecology office. That makes sense, right? Women with ovaries are going to the gynecologist. But they didn't understand basic practices of who goes to the gynecologist and when and for what reasons and what are their ages and what are the challenges that they might be facing. And they ended up with a very biased sample simply because they didn't know the lived epistemology. They didn't understand women going to the gynecology office because they weren't women.
So in that situation, like, what could they have done to troubleshoot? Ask the right questions.
Bring in women. We cannot measure effectively. We cannot design research effectively. We cannot create products or determine marketing or improve sales if we have just one small group. We need that lived epistemology.
That's what I love about org development, is that it's mm-hmm. a whole systems approach. And we are
right.
Like the purpose is to bring all the voices into be representing all of the voices in the organization, that we are mm-hmm. having listening sessions with not just our managers, not just our leader executive team, but the ones who are living in that experience, that see
Absolutely.
the issues day to day, that know mm-hmm. the processes that are every single day, you know, supporting the work that they do. So to me, it sounds like if we want to solve problems, we have to ask the people who are being affected by the problems, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it really is just basic. And
yeah.
And it's okay. We cannot be everything to everybody. That's why functional diversity is so important in an organization. So back to those measures, right?
Mm-hmm.
So do you have signs, which all you have to do is take a look at the demographic data. Do you have signs of organizational replication?
Mm-hmm.
And that includes where people are coming from, where they've been educated, even degree types and whatever makes sense for your organization. The next piece that I was talking about is, does your organization appreciate diversity, right? There are some measures out there that can capture that. And it's not just simply men and women or race or religion. It's diversity of thought, diversity of approach, diversity of experiences. And how is that welcomed? I'll give an example of a place that did not accept diversity of thought. And that was NASA, back during both the Apollo 1 and the Challenger accident. They have since gone back and taken a look at their organizational structure. And in both cases, there were people who were expertise in the area that they were calling, saying, this flight should not take place. This launch should not take place. I'm concerned because we lack data in point X, Y, and Z, and we can't predict how this is going to respond. And in both cases, a larger group that was very, very homogenous in its nature, in its experience, in its thought, overrode the expertise, and lives were lost. Now, at that point, what they recognized was that the organization was set up literally to put out this one voice. It was not valuing and appreciating the diversity of thought. And how can an organization move forward? And maybe your organization, when they make that kind of mistake, it's not going to result in loss of lives, but it could result in loss of sales. The other two areas of measurement, though, that are absolutely critical are, does your culture of your organization assume innocence or guilt? And does your culture of your organization assume competence or incompetence? One of the things that we've been finding in organizations that lack an appreciation of diversity and actually have the presence of either racism or sexism or ageism in is that it will pick up in these two spaces. Now, I want you to think about when we bring up the concept of racism, just as an example.
Yeah.
People's working memory shuts down. They get defensive. They back up. Mm-hmm. Even when we bring up the topic of bias, their working memory shuts down. They back up. They're like, that's not me. But if we switch the conversation and we're not talking about the individual, we're talking about trends in the organization that show this idea of, is a person competent? Are we assuming competence? So right now I have the fortune of working with an organization that has, everybody is assumed competent, right? We have this measure, we can see it. And what does that translate into? When a person makes a mistake, the first thought isn't, oh, that person's incompetent. Of course they made a mistake. The thought is, first, are they okay? Right? Mm-hmm. Is everything going on? Are they okay? Is there something that they need? The next thought immediately goes to, are the systems in the organization in place that are facilitating or inhibiting this person's ability to be successful? That's a completely different space than another organization that I work with that literally when I went to collect data, I had not one, not two, not three, but four African-American employees, all with doctoral degrees, all with doctoral degrees. One of the doctoral degrees was from Cornell. Another of the doctoral degrees, she had an MD, PhD from Johns Hopkins. Every single one of these African-American PhDs told me that they were told that the only reason why they were hired was because they were Black.
Oh my goodness, that's...
And we're not talking 30 years ago.
No, this
we're
is...
talking recent data.
Ooh.
Okay?
And
we're talking highly accomplished people. But we already knew this with the measure. The measure itself, when we took this measure, it's like five items. We knew that the culture itself, that everybody had to prove their competence first, that they were assumed incompetent. And when you have an organization like that, people are spending so much time justifying their existence, why they're there, protecting their job, protecting their income, protecting their self-esteem. They're not moving the organization forward. This is not healthy for anybody. You add to this that this is going to add additional stress, which is going to cause health problems, which is going to increase, sick leave and health insurance costs. And, you know, this is a really bad place to be. But we're not talking about any one individual. We're talking about an entire culture that has created it. This environment, and this actually is trainable because nobody wants to be in an environment like that. You can come in with professional development and move that forward. Less likely to occur in an organizational environment, and I work in educational environments, and we see this more in educational environments, is the assumption of guilt versus innocence. So the assumption that, for example, teachers are guilty, they're going to take the easy way out. They're going to have their students cheat on tests, stuff like that, or that students themselves are always guilty and they have to prove their innocence. And this is exhausting.
Yeah.
It's tiring, and it's not going to move an organization forward. And for an educational environment, it's not going to help students learn.
Yeah, it would lead to burnout, and it has all these other ripple effects in both of those situations that you were
Absolutely.
Explaining. And psychological safety. It is something that we could measure, and
Absolutely.
Partly related to a lot of these these measurements that you're already talking about around, you know, being the appreciation for, you know, being able to make mistakes and feeling safe in those environments and feeling like there's no consequence if I want to speak my mind.
Right. That appreciation of the diversity of thought. One other measure which works, it tends to work more for people with physical disabilities and women, and that is physical safety.
Oh,
so
huge.
We don't even think about how important that is, but these are all measures that, you know, depending on where you are in the organization, you might not have that full 360. And that's why the right targeted measures in your organization can illuminate. And take a look at the measures that you can change. You can train your organization or create policy that can improve each of these things. We all have cognitive biases. We were born with them. It's evolutionarily pre-wired. These are going to be much harder to change. And implicit bias, we're not consciously aware of it, also harder to change. Let's focus on the variables that we can change. And in the process, the organization will improve and we'll be able to move forward.
Yeah. One of the other things that I wanted to speak with you about was the challenge that we face within organizations or IO psychologists or OD practitioners with trying to measure different facets of an organization because of the response rates. And typically when I go to administer like an engagement survey, for example, I'll generally hear if we have a lower response rate that quarter or that cycle, I'll generally hear there's survey fatigue, right? And it's not just within the organization I work with. I hear it all the time. There's survey fatigue. And I think one of the big misnomers is that survey fatigue is that lack of participation in a survey, but it's caused by, oh, there's too many surveys or the length of a survey is too long. We don't have the time to take it. But I think where I've noticed or observed in my organization, a lack of response is due to the inability to close the gap between feedback and action.
Oh, that's beautiful.
In a very quick, or at least in a time span that makes sense for the people that are being affected.
That is such a good point. I'm going to tell you a quick story about this one organization.
Please do.
I was called in to take a look at a measure that they had created that actually was used to determine things like salary, retention, promotion. Like this was an important measure, right? And it was 10 items. And I'm looking at this measure going, wow, you've missed, like I'm asking them, what are the critical components of this particular job? And none of them were in the measure. None of them, right? They had items in the measure that they could have checked in other ways without needing the measure, right? Like was the person showing up to work on time and leaving on time, right? You don't need that in a measure.
Right? No. What is that telling you?
Right. This stuff is easy. And the way that that question was worded is if the person showed up early and stayed later, they actually were punished. So this was really strange. But, you know, I'm looking and I'm like, look, you're missing the key components of what this job is. Why these 10 items? And they're like, well, we decided that 10 items would be the right number because we don't want survey fatigue. And I'm like, wait, what? So we need to first start with what is it that you're intending to measure, right? What is that? What are you hoping to try to measure? And will it be accurate? And will the information come back to you in a manner that is useful, right? And so that, again, that's back to the validity. And sometimes that might take a few extra items in order to get that full view. And if it does, then go ahead. Make sure that you put that in there. Because if the measure's not valid, in my opinion, it's even unethical to administer. Especially if you're using it to make decisions.
Yes, especially if you're using it.
Especially if you're using it to make decisions. But even if you're just using it to get a landscape of what's going on and it's not accurate, you've just wasted a bunch of people's time, and that's unethical. So get the measure valid, and how long does it need to be? as long as it needs to be, right? And there are lots of different techniques that psychometricians have to shorten the length of time and to ease that while still making it valid. So that's one piece. However, what you had brought up is another very important piece. And my experience has been that one of the biggest reasons why people will not complete a measure or they'll skip items is because of face validity, right? This isn't actually, face validity isn't actual validity. It's how the person who is taking the test views several things about the test. First of all, who's administering the test and can they trust that person?
Yes.
Right? And so if there's a trust issue with who's measuring, who's giving out the test and who's getting the results back, if they don't trust that person and what they're going to do with that data, they're not going to respond. And if they do, they're going to skip items or they're not going to respond accurately. So that's one. Another is sometimes people put in quirky little pieces of a measure and it will actually get people annoyed, right? So let's take one particular item. So the federal government recognizes people of Middle Eastern descent as white. Mm-hmm. It's a long history as to why this happened. And so if you are Middle Eastern and you are, you know, doing the census, you list yourself as white. What's interesting is people will say, well, I'm going to take the federal government's definition of these various races, including Middle Eastern, when I collect data from people. Except, first of all, you're missing out on information. But from the test taker's perspective, if you're sitting there and you're Middle Eastern and you've experienced life differently because you're from a collectivistic culture and people look at you and maybe have responded to you differently because of being of Middle Eastern descent. Now people want you sit there and you're like, but I don't identify with being white. Same happens with gender/sex, right? If there's not a place for a person to say, but this is who I am. And, then now all of a sudden you're like, well, you don't care who I am. Yeah. And if you don't care who I am, that could be enough to keep you from responding the rest of the way.
Yeah. Like I'm not seen, I'm not valued, I'm not included in this.
Exactly. Exactly. And if you're not including and valuing me at the most basic level of my identity,
yeah,
are you going to listen to anything that I have to say? There are in certain survey software, you have an option where people could put more than one choice or other or whatever. But when you have these forced choices that you absolutely have no other choice and you can only pick one and you're sitting there going, but that's just not quite it, right? And now a person, again, this communicates information back to the respondent that you really don't care what I have to say. And so at this point, the face validity is diminished. All of these things will stop the information, but the point that you brought up is a most critical face validity, and that is, how is this data going to be used?
Mm.
Can this data be used to come back to haunt me, right?
Yeah.
Or is this just going to be one more set of data that's going to sit somewhere and nothing's going to come from it? And so one of the best things that an organization can do is show how, here's the measure, here it is, and give a timeline when you give out the measure.
Yeah.
You know, we anticipate, remind people, say, look, this is going to take a while for us to evaluate, for us to take a look at, and say, we expect to have a preliminary report by, and give a date, and then stick to that date, and then have recommendations that come out of it. I'm going to give a quick example to an organization that, interestingly enough, had an issue of low on trust. We knew this going in from focus group data that I had collected, and they were hoping to measure organizational well-being so that they could come up with targeted improvement, but they were low on organizational trust, which meant if the measure came from organizational leadership, people weren't going to respond. So we had the measure come from me. And
the outside party,
they were, and in the process and in the directions, I made it clear it's never going to them. They will only see the cumulative data. Any of your responses would be scrubbed, blah, 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 blah. And I stuck to that. But what was more important is one of the areas that came up as a problem in the organization, because trust is a tough thing to move,
Yes.
was culture of respect. Culture of respect is much easier to move. And so this organization had zero awards, none. So
Why?
I sat with the organization and I'm like, look, you need to show respect. And they're like, oh, we have union contracts, we have this, we have that, we can't do anything. They literally came up with this opportunity that people would go online and type in, hey, I caught so and so doing a great job. And there was no standard whatever, like I really appreciate so and so. And so included things like the custodians, the groundskeeper. I went into the bathroom and I noticed how nice and clean it was. I really appreciate the work the custodian's doing. And everybody from one end to the other. And these little papers went out with the organization's logo and a nice, cute little, caught doing well or whatever, little cute little saying. And it had this what the person typed in exactly. Like this is, and the next thing you walk on this or on this in this organization, and on the custodian's door, you see these little notes taped up. And then once they hit 10, then they got recognized at a larger function. And how much money did it cost? The larger function was almost nothing. The printing these things out was almost nothing. And it immediately turned around, people starting to feel valued and appreciated.
Appreciating is free. I mean, like we talk about this all the time in my organization to recognize your peer-to-peers. It's free to do, and people need it. They want it. And it's human nature to want to feel valued. And it's going back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? We absolutely
Absolutely.
need to feel appreciated. And that's why I say need, not want, because it is, I think, in my opinion, a need.
No, you're absolutely right. And the other thing, though, too, that happens is when we show gratitude individually, like I am so grateful for the work that you're doing, that feeds us too. And it had such an immediate impact on this organization. But none of this would have happened if they didn't appreciate the trust issue and if they didn't work around making sure the measure. By the way, that organization said the measure was too long. And we ended up with a 73% response rate and long, like the stuff that came out in the open-ended questions were long. People spent a lot of time on this because they wanted to be heard and they believed that they were going to be heard. And the questions were such that they felt like they were going to be heard.
So, what do you think is a good response rate?
It depends on an organization. For me, though, in general, I start to get unsettled when my response rate is below 50%. I am. Depending on some of the work that I've done, I've had response rates near close to 100%. But it's again, it really comes down to that face validity and that building of rapport. In the space where I had the where I pretty consistently had close to 100% response rate, we had a really careful protocol put into place so that nobody ever felt pressured. Or bothered, but that at every point, any time a measure went out and the results came back, there was a summary of results given to everybody, the part that were appropriate to give out to everybody, the good, the bad, the ugly, right? In fact, that's how I normally, here's the good, here's the bad, here's the really ugly, and now here's what we're planning to do about it. But because I think the organization itself and it really appreciated that they were going to be heard and that rapport was built up, We were able to get to 100%. Most of the time, I don't have the opportunity to build up that level of rapport. And so, you know, we're dealing with a lot of other challenges that are there. But if the measure, if we value the measure, then time during work, that's one of the things that we have found, is that allocating time during work for people, particularly, remember back to that organization with the custodians and you know, other types of work staff, it's not fair to assume that they had access to, you know, computers and their email and so forth out of work time. And so, you know, by providing them with more than enough time during work and a place to do it where they can feel safe, where they feel like nobody's looking over their shoulder, is very important. And also keeping in mind that that particular measure was a complicated one because it was at an organization with lots of differing levels of education, including people who, you know, reading might have been a challenge, or English might not have even been their primary language. And putting into place a very safe environment where they could feel like they could get somebody to, you know, that they didn't need to disclose that they couldn't read, that that English wasn't their second, you know, that they weren't comfortable in reading in English or whatever it is. By having that built into the measure, I think that also helped with the response rates. But again, it comes back to what you had said. You need to know who you're measuring. You need to know. And without that, and actually I have a funny story with that. So the project was handed over to somebody else before it was given back to me. Somebody wanted to look through it, and they went through and they changed. I had set the readability up on this measure at about a fourth grade level, which was not an easy task, but I did it. And somebody else looked at it and thought that, that it could be written better, and rewrote items and changed the readability from fourth to ninth grade like that.
Oh, and, my goodness. Talk about taking out of context, right?
Right. And you know, and this person was like, well, you know, I'm in English, blah, 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 blah. Like, yeah, but.
That's it. I mean, so you spoke there a little bit about the trust, and we've got kind of different levels of trust then. We have the manager who's supporting me and enabling me to enabling the safe environment for me to take this assessment in. But then we also have this perception of trust at the organizational level, right? At the top. And what are they going to do with it? And when, let's say, for example, the action that's taken after a survey has been administered is maybe not to the liking of an organization or those employees. It's not as quick enough. When it comes to trust, it's you said it's one of the harder things to move. I've written it down. Culture of respect is easier, but it's very quick to diminish, right?
Oh, it is. And do remember, most people are reasonable. So there are, remember I told you about that measure of culture of respect was problematic, and they immediately came out with these little notes of gratitude, right? That was not where they stopped. That's where they started, right? So if you can put into place something that is tangible, addressing whatever it is that you just measured, right? Because there are other issues that, again, you know, back to organizations that might be unionized, right? Some of that change is going to take a while. But there are some pieces of the change that are easy. So literally prioritize, go after that low hanging fruit, right? Make some immediate change and bring it back to, you know, this came out of this particular measure, and say, however, here are our goals going forward, right? And because if we're talking about something that needs to be changed that has, you know, a major financial investment or has hiring requirements, you know, we can't, that has contractual issues that need to be altered. Some of these things cannot be moved, you know, you can't move it on a dime. It takes a little bit of time. People understand that, but that doesn't mean that you have to wait. There's always something you can do immediately.
So to recap,
but don't stop there.
Yeah. So to recap, grab the low hanging fruit, make some quick wins that are meaningful and impactful, and then communicate frequently, right? When it comes to what the plan is and what those goals are, and don't just go silent on, maybe you make maybe the first communication that you come out and you make the plan and you share that, you don't follow back up with that communication later on, maybe a couple months down the road. Let's at least share the progress we've made towards that goal, right? Let's at least share, we know this program that we're designing is really important to you. It's one of those goals that we said would take a little bit of time. Here's where we are today.
Right? Absolutely.
Maybe I don't know exactly when it will be able to be launched or deployed within the organization. I don't have that answer to today, but we know that here's the progress we've made so far, and this is what we're shooting for. At least that, right?
Absolutely. And effective communication is one of the key constructs of an organization that, again, it's much easier to change than most people realize.
Yeah.
And getting that information out, and even if it's just an updated email, and everybody's like, well, email fatigue, right? People are going to miss it. I was just in a meeting the other day, and somebody had said, you know, something like, oh, I haven't heard such thing about da 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 da. And we're like, oh yeah, that email came out by this person. And one person said it was 2 weeks ago and another person said it was 2 days ago. And it ended up, all of us were a little wrong.
Yeah.
We got the who the email was from and when the email came out was a little wrong, but enough of the people in that particular group had read it that we all went back to reread it. And now everybody felt really good about it. And so you don't even need to have everybody in the organization read the communication. You just need some of them. And they pick that up. And when the conversation comes up at the water cooler or the Zoom room or wherever it is that the organization folks are meeting, and they're like, yeah, whatever happened with that?
Yeah.
All you need is one person to say, oh, there was a memo on that. But bring it up and keep that moving forward. But it's true with anything. You know, if you're trying to lose weight and you get on that scale and you get that, you know, I lost a half a pound, it feeds you, right? If you're in a relationship and you're like, oh, I get to hear from the person that I love that they love me back, right? It feeds you. Organizations need to feed their employees with, yes, we're listening to you, we value you, and we're moving forward.
I love that. Okay, well, we should wrap up. I just feel like I've been brought back to the classroom and just been fascinated having this conversation with you. Immediately feel like I'm sitting in front of you in a class and you're just teaching away. And I'm just loving it. But I have one final question for you.
Yes.
And I like to kind of end all of the podcast episodes with this question. What's the most recent paradigm shift that you've experienced related to either this work or anything outside of it?
Wow, we're in the middle of a paradigm shift right now. and I have the privilege of seeing educational research move forward. And we have not been making good progress in educational achievement. We spend a lot of money, we spend a lot of time. We are still not serving a large group of students. And the paradigm shift that I'm seeing is in educational research is starting to ground with the psychological phenomena that we know about child development, cognitive development, psychometrics, methodology, and that information is being translated into practice that's more targeted to the individual student level. It's similar to a paradigm shift that occurred in medicine, referred to as translational medicine, that started in about the 1990s, that really has taken hold. And it truly is this difference of approach where they're taking the basic foundational research and looking at the patient and adjusting to that patient. And I'm seeing that movement in education. It is slower than I would like it to be, but it is definitely a paradigm shift that I think will start with education, but that will move over into other areas. And I think that IO Psych does that naturally, where you're relying upon what do we know about humans and behavior and about methodology and about psychometrics, and how do we pull that all together to move the organization forward in a better fashion. And I think that the more effective we are at that translation of the science, which also translates information back, what are we missing? What don't we know? What do we need to measure better? Right, that back and forth. I think that as we move forward in that space in education, I think we will reach more students faster. And that's my hope.
Wow. Do you think that momentum will pick up kind of like a snowball effect over the next few years? Like, what's your estimated amount?
I'm doing everything in my
I
power to make sure
know.
that that happens.
Such
So,
important work. Such important
thank
work.
you. Yes, it's exciting work.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all that you do and all of the communities and the institutions that you serve. I really enjoyed this conversation. And I look forward to our listeners hearing more.
Thank you. You take care and good luck.
Thank you. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to leave a review, rate, and subscribe wherever you're listening. If you know a business leader in practice or friend who you think would be interested in this episode, please consider sharing it with them. I am so grateful for your support. For more updates, you can follow us at Paradigm Shifts Podcast on Instagram. See you on the next episode.